Hey guys, my name's Int 80. I'm the rapper in Dual Core. I'd like to rap for you to intro this talk.
Thanks for coming in. We're going to start with some baseline questions. What's your name and what do you do?
I'm Int 80. I'm the rapper in Dual Core.
Where are you from?
Cincinnati.
And why are you here?
Well, there's plenty of possibilities, explaining my guest appearance, investigating my clearance up to test my perseverance. Basically, I'm here cause these feds just wanna battle me, turning my brain waves against my DIY mentality. Looking for the pattern of a hacker in the brain, I'm monitoring the heart rate of a rapper in the veins. Eyes on the prize while they're mapping all the waves. These wires make me feel like I'm shackled up in chains. Keep pace, try to hide and change visibly. Too fast for readings, gotta crank the sensitivity. Heart rate, pressure, pulse, better not skip a beat. Alchemy is science, magic or the wizardry. Show the source, let us see how they play, or I'll just disassemble and drop a zero day. A red herring flaw, lacking reasons for their claims. Defeated in these games, so I'm seeking neon rain.
Who's the best rap group in Nerdcore in the iTunes store?
That's us, Dual Core.
Who makes the best beats rocking on the boards? Produce a high score.
C64.
Who's the best rapper that's known to spit crazy and baby kick babies?
Interrupt 80.
And the number one hacker, the infamous legend who brings the end map Armageddon.
Gregory Evans?
Thanks.
Thank you so much. That is the best introduction ever.
Thank you. So without further ado, it's my pleasure, and without further laptop hacks or rage or frustration, it's my pleasure to introduce Rain and Urban Monkey, and they're going to show you some really cool lie detector polygraph stuff. Make some noise for them, please.
Thank you so much, Anita. You totally rock my world. Thank you so much. That was so awesome. And thank you guys for waiting. I apologize for the technical difficulties. So without any further ado, I assume you guys all know by now that you're in build a lie detector, beat a lie detector. We're both from the Neuronumerist group. Joe Barrett couldn't make it this year, so Urban Monkey took the bullet and came instead. And as Int told you, this is actually my fifth year here speaking at DEF CON. So 5 years. So, you know, some people get paper and stuff. I get a Nerdcore. It's Nerdcore rap traditional for your introduction for your fifth year speech. So, but to tell you the truth, I really almost didn't make it this year. Now, I know that Neuronumerist every year, there comes with the madness of pulling things off at the last minute. That is part of our charm. But truth be told, I really wasn't feeling it this year. So, for several reasons, I've become so disillusioned with the whole concept of neurohacking that I actually wanted to quit it completely. So, my dear friend and fellow member, Tottenkopf, who I know is here somewhere, she told me that the problem is I've just been pushing myself too hard lately, working on these year-long projects to bring to you guys. So, she actually suggested to me that I take this year off. Since I've accidentally ended up in the shoes of being Neuronumerist's spokesperson, it really didn't go over well with the rest of the group that I wanted to take a year off. Because how it works is we start working on our projects. As soon as I walk off the stage, we will be working on the next project. So it was really unfair to Urban Monkey and the rest of the group that I was like, I'm out. So a huge argument started with how much obligation I actually had to the group. And this caused a major rift. The infighting was crazy. And the polygraph project actually ended up in the back burner for many, many months while this was going on. So finally, Psychedelic Bike, who's painfully brilliant, by the way, he's a painfully brilliant man, he came up with a solution, a way that I could both take a year off and still be a spokesperson for the group. And it was really simple. The idea was we would just build a robot to download my memories into, and no one would be the wiser while the real Rain stayed home eating bonbons and having a well-deserved rest. So at what point did you figure out I was lying to you? Was there something subtle that seemed off in my story before it obviously went down the path of the improbable? Did my body language tip you off? Did I show any stress gestures? Was I blinking? Swallowing too hard, fidgeting. I'm always fidgeting, so I mean. Did my story lack in detail? How about my vocal pitch? Was there anything off about that? Too many pauses, perhaps? Then again, how much of what I just told you was a lie? All of it? Some of it? None of it? More than 3 decades of psychological research has shown that most individuals are horribly bad at figuring out when they're being lied to. The average person does barely any better than chance. But you can't blame them, because there's no universal, unique, telltale sign that someone is lying to you, no matter what you've heard. But don't feel too downhearted about it. Even if you are a police officer or a judge who had been trained in the art of detecting deception, the training might improve your accuracy, but it would only be a few percentage points at the most. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that detecting lies is complicated, because lies themselves are complicated things. A lie is not in the words we say, after all, or even in the lack of words. It's in the attention of the deceiver. However offensive this concept may be to you, deception comes naturally in all living things. Camouflage being only one of the many examples of how nature amply rewards successful deceivers by allowing them to survive long enough to mate and reproduce. According to the calculations made by a psychologist at the University of Southern California, human beings will lie to you about 200 times a day. That works out to roughly one untruth every 5 minutes. So figure out what the last one I just told you was. Next slide. So throughout history, the truth has been a slippery thing for us to put our fingers on. And the progress of the human race has always been darkened by the self-made horrors of humans designed, found within severe mental and physical pain that one group of human beings can seemingly without remorse or judgment put another group of human beings to in the name of justice. So, from ancient times to the Middle Ages, Germanic laws were essentially unwritten tribal customs that evolved from popular practice that moved with the tribe. If property was stolen or someone was injured or killed, a payment would be made to the guilty person to pay the victim or the families the owner of property. This payment was a price that was considered amends. I'm sure you've all heard of blood money. So that was to pay off, to make amends. It was within Germanic law that the ordeal came to be a means by which the accused may clear themselves. Tribal ordeal was a practice that the guilt or innocence of the accused was determined by subjecting them to unpleasant, usually a dangerous experience. In some cases, the accused was considered innocent if they survived the test or if their injuries healed. In other cases, only death was considered proof of innocence. The reasoning went that those who had done nothing wrong would be kept from harm by divine intervention. Even if the accused happened to die during the ordeal, it was still considered at the time to be entirely fair because everyone knew that they'd go on to a suitable reward or punishment in the afterlife. Trials by ordeal became rarer over the Middle Ages because it was often replaced by confessions under torture, so you can decide whether or not that was a trade-up. But the practice was discontinued only in the 16th century. So, sorry about my slides being cut off. Nobody reads them anyway, we all know that. Trial by combat was a method of Germanic law to settle accusations in the absence of witnesses or a confession, in which two parties in dispute fought against each other in combat, and the winner of the fight was proclaimed to be right. So it remained in use throughout the Middle Ages, gradually disappearing in the course of the 16th century, like trial by ordeal. But interestingly enough, trial by ordeal is generally known in one form or another in many cultures worldwide. And trial by combat was probably a custom of the Germanic people. Now, to the Greeks and the Romans, the truth was something impersonal, separate from, and greater than an individual, and most certainly greater than an individual who is of low status or had been born into a captive birth. The truth was thought to reside not only in the witness's words, but to be locked within their living flesh. And it was the torturer's task to pry out it through the medium of pain. Now, I know to you that the belief of extreme pain was a guarantee of the truth seems crazy counterintuitive because to us today, because our instincts tell us that a tortured witness would agree to absolutely anything. But what you need to understand that is that our present view is rooted in the very modern philosophical sense that the individual self, as an autonomous being, is in the possession of its own truth. Now, The invention of the police did not come without growing pains, and early American police departments were typically brutal and corrupt. During the early part of the 20th century, the routine torture used by American domestic police when it came to dealing with deception was given the quaint nickname of the third degree. Confessions obtained by using such techniques as bright lights, deprivation of food, physical discomfort, long isolation, and beating with instruments that didn't leave marks were usually admissible in court as long as someone signed a piece of paper that was a waiver saying that they had done it voluntarily. Between the 1930s and the 1960s, a national uproar actually began, and they started cracking down on police tactics and gradually changed the practice of police interrogation. So by the 1950s, the confessions were considered involuntary, not only if the police had actually harmed the suspect, but had also caused what they considered mental harm by depriving them of sleep, food, water, or bathroom facilities, promised them some benefit if the subject confessed, or threatened them with harm if they didn't confess. In the world today, we rely on a legal system to sort our liars from our truth tellers. Two of the most commonplace legal systems are the adversarial system and the inquisitorial system. I'm going to hate saying that through the whole speech. Inquisitorial. In the adversarial system, two or more opposing parties gather evidence and present the evidence. This is bad stapling job. Present the evidence and the arguments to judge or jury. The judge or jury knows nothing of the litigation until the parties present their case to the decision makers. The defendant in a criminal trial is not required to testify. But in the inquisitorial system, the presiding judge is not a passive recipient of the information. Rather, the presiding judge is primarily responsible for supervising and gathering the evidence necessary to resolve the case. He or she actively steers the search for evidence and questions the witness, including the respondents or defendants. Attorneys play a more passive role, and they suggest routes of inquiry for the presiding judge to follow, the judge questioning, and then they follow it with a tiny bit of questioning of their own. The reason the attorneys don't question too much is very brief is because the judge tries to ask all the relevant questions, so they're kind of just add-ons. So basically, the adversarial system, which of course is the system in America, seeks the truth by pitting parties against each other in a hope that competition will reveal the truth, and it places a premium on the individual's rights. But the inquisitorial system seeks the truth by questioning those most familiar to the events in the dispute and placing the rights of the accused secondary for the search of the truth. So, as you can see, our efforts as a society have changed through the years in the way that we treat those that we believe to deceive us. But since the early 1900s, science has endeavored to create a more human method to unravel the tales of deceivers.
So, the modern polygraph as we know it was developed near the end of the 1920s. And would change very little over the coming decades. Its creators were not the first people to use scientific instrumentation as an aid in detecting lies or monitoring blood pressure during questioning. In fact, they weren't even the first to use the word polygraph to describe the device. They were, however, the first to put it in a portable form for use in the field and the first to design and market specifically for police application. Another thing that made this particular polygraph attractive was that it could potentially replace the existing brutal third-degree method, which had been brought to the public's attention through media during the first couple of decades of the 1900s. Such bad publicity had been putting a great deal of public pressure on police departments. Initially, the polygraph was limited to a small number of police departments, but its use slowly spread along with its reputation. There was little attention focused on the polygraph by the general media in the 1920s, though a few articles published were almost always positive. During the 1930s, use of the lie detector began to slowly move into other areas of use, with a ghoulish example being its use on death row inmates being given exams as a consideration when determining a stay of execution. The use of the machine, though, was still mainly limited to a small number of police agencies and some minor use through other government agencies. But it was beginning to see an increase in use in a small number of businesses in the private sector. During the 1930s, most of the media accounts were still full of praise for the polygraph, with very little criticism and attention being devoted to its level of accuracy or reliability. This despite the fact that the developers and proponents of the device were all members of the academic world. Concerns on its effects to rights to privacy and the right to not self-incriminate arose very rarely. As the 1940s began, so did the polygraph's growing amount of publicity and media coverage. Though the majority of the numbers released on how successful the machines were coming from the polygraph industry itself. The accuracy of the device was still rarely challenged. One of the reasons for this was its continued rejection of polygraphs in the court system, with all the major names in the field either shifting their attention away from or dying. Combined with the court's rejection of its results, the polygraph may have been expected to continue to fall out of favor. However, as the middle of the 1940s marched into the 1950s, use of the device by businesses and governments would soon substantially increase as the paranoia over the Cold War and McCarthyism spread. Now, as we all know, the middle and late 1950s was a time of great distrust and false accusations. This environment would bring a sharp increase in use of the polygraph, especially by the federal government, and then slowly spreading to other levels of government. That, in turn, led to more media attention of the instrument, and a small but growing number of critical articles began to question the fundamental principles behind the polygraph itself. The days of its complete uncritical acceptance were passing. As demand grew, so did the number of private polygraph firms. And most of the numbers generally cited as proof of the instrument's accuracy were still industry-generated. During this time, we also saw the emergence of challenges being issued to submit to the machine. For the first time, attention was being paid to the use of the polygraph for intimidation and political ends, rather than as a deception-detecting means. Through the 1960s, the use of the polygraph would continue to spread, especially in the federal government and private sector. Both its usage and complaints of its use began to increase to the extent that Congress became involved by holding hearings, issuing reports, and making recommendations on the polygraph. Individual states began to limit the use of the instrument and to license operators. As in the past, though, courts continued to reject results as evidence, and business use began to dramatically increase, especially in the pre-employment testing of job applicants, as this group of people were not unionized and had no protection against it whatsoever. A greater portion of attention was becoming critical as opponents began to point out the glaring faults and deficiencies of the instrument, and the fact that the rapid increase in use had been based on little more than claims of the polygraph industry itself. Many articles during this period were definitely in favor of the machine, but even those writers felt compelled to at least mention some of the faults and some of the criticisms. Although the government continued to use the instrument, the 1970s saw media interest mainly focused on business use of the device, as employee polygraph screening became a multi-million dollar industry. The attraction of the polygraph for businesses seemed to be its relatively low cost and quick speed in comparison with traditional investigation of job applicants. Legal activity continued as more states took action and the federal government threatened but failed to enact any legislation. During the early 1980s, court use of the polygraph began to see some minor gains, despite the fact that criticism against it had dramatically increased. In addition to being widely reported that polygraph results were being used by prosecutors in determining who to prosecute and in plea bargains, in a number of jurisdictions, rape charges would not even begin to be investigated until the victim had submitted to and passed a polygraph exam. Federal use of the polygraph increased during the 1980s, drawing a great deal of media coverage, most of it highly critical. It took until 1988 until use of the polygraph in most business applications was curtailed by federal law, even though criticism of the accuracy and validity had been building for years. One may have expected that the polygraph would begin to fade away with the passing of the Employee Polygraph Protection Act, all but abolishing the private sector's ability to use it, but it didn't. Government continued to use the device through the 1990s, and in 1998, a Supreme Court ruling left it up to individual jurisdictions whether polygraph results could be submitted as evidence in a court case if both parties agreed to its use and at the judge's discretion. But it was really the unfortunate tragedy of September 11th that would really breathe new life into the continued use of the polygraph. Last year, as a group, the Neuronumerous Group built a sleep lab, and we built it from scratch. For the project this year, it was decided that building and designing schematics from scratch is just a lot of work, and we wanted to do what we could do to avoid doing it again. So after some quality time with Google, a keyboard, and some coffee, Rain came across a project out of Cornell University by Jordan Crittenden and Edward Lai. There is a URL, you just can't see it, sorry. So it was decided that this would be a good opportunity to use as a starting point for our project, since they built theirs for less than $50, and that fit our budget of paperclip pretty well. Jordan Edwin's design measured pulse rate, galvanic skin response, or GSR, breathing rate, and stress of the individual's voice. Ours was built mostly from their schematics, although an existing piece of hardware generously provided by Seth Hardy was used for reading pulse rate. And we also didn't measure voice stress level. We also ended up using a slightly different method to record breathing rate. The Cornell design initially used a thermistor mounted on a dust mask, which we also included in our initial build-out, which Psychedelic Bike did. However, we decided to add our own touch. Another member, Ol Grover, designed a breathing band that works pretty much like the commercial machines do by going around your chest. At the core is a simple slide potentiometer, which is probably the single most expensive part of the device. The rest is simply a plastic box, a spiral phone cable, phone jack, an elastic band, and ribbon with cable with straps to help hold it around the chest, and of course, to make it China compliant, hot glue. You can't really see the at the bottom of the slide is where the phone cable plugs in. Initially, the band itself was designed with an elastic band all the way around the chest, but there was a tendency for that to bind, and it didn't really have the tension to properly pull on the slider for the potentiometer. After some experimentation, you see the result on the screen there. It's just ribbon and elastic band. The spiral foam cord was used, again, because it's cheap, but it was also thought that it would be helpful for people moving around just to get the stretch out of the cable, which was dead bang on. We also decided that instead of laying out all of the components on a single board like the Cornell guys did, it would be sleeker to have a box like you see. It was a pain in the ass. What we didn't think about was that opening and closing the box all the time would cause movement on the wires, causing signal crossover, which gave us some really odd results at times. So if you do end up building one, don't use a box. It'll be easier for you. After getting it built and tested, if you see at the bottom there, that microcontroller is an Atmel controller. It is labeled, but you can't see the label, unfortunately. After we'd built it, we found that Jordan and Edwin recommended not to power the machine from a wall and to use a battery to power it. It was something about safety. Even after figuring this out, after reading it, we totally ignored it. If you do decide to build one, please read their webpage just so that you understand the safety concerns that they had in powering it from the wall. The software that the Cornell team used was written in MATLAB. Although another numerous member, Christian Gruber, wrote ours in Java because that's what he knows. It also allowed him to develop on his Mac and easily deploy it to our Ubuntu box that we used. While it is possible to run the software on a Mac, because data is sent over a serial port, you'll need to use a USB to serial adapter running at 38.4. Some of the cheaper ones don't do that speed, so just be careful if you do end up buying one, what you buy. If you're doing this on Windows, the software wasn't designed for Windows, so it's at your own peril. The user interface was built using JCC Kit and Java Builder Swing. Overall, the software can be built with the Apache Maven project. We were using version 2.2.1, although any version higher should work, as well as Java 1.6. The source code is available, as you see, at code.google.com/p/neuronumerous. It's built using the Mercurial source control system, and all of our software is open source. Once this was built, running, and collecting data, we were quickly running out of time. Our cry for lab rats was thankfully answered by 16 people, including myself, through mid-July of this year, giving Psychedelic Bike, the gentleman who built the machine, about 1 week to go over data that was written out by hand by Rain.
So now you've seen our beautiful ghetto polygraph, you know, very beautiful. When we took special care to try and make sure that our testing environment would be as close to the polygraph industry standards as possible, right? Because, you know, we totally wanted to be able to have data that would be comparable. We tried to keep the environment quiet with few distractions. We limited the amount of people allowed in the room during the time the examination took place, so that was a variable that wouldn't interfere. Standards dictate that the room temperature should be between 70 to 75 degrees Fahrenheit for the Americans we had in the room. That works out to 21 to 24 degrees Celsius for the rest of the world. Unfortunately, at the time we were doing testing, the city that we both live in was in the midst of a heat wave. So if you remember that we told you that galvanic is a variable that works on sweat, so we did try to make sure we didn't take any polygraph testing during the worst of it, but it'd be disingenuous. Well, it would definitely feel disingenuous to me if I didn't tell you that during the worst of the heat wave, there were times that our testing environment could be up to 3 degrees hotter than what was recommended by the industry. But we didn't see any major change between the times that it was hotter and what it wasn't. But I did want to tell you that, just so, you know, full disclaimer. Now, because the standard polygraph actually takes up to 3 hours to complete, we kept it really simple by instead going with a common pretest by polygraph examiners known as the numbers test. So how the numbers test works is that you're asked to lie to the examiner about a number. So the polygraph examiner gives you a piece of paper and a pen, and he says, I want you to write down a number that's in between these three numbers. Pick 4, 5, or 6. And so you write your chosen number down on the piece of paper. And the polygraph examiner can see what you've written down. It's no secret to what you've written down. So after you've written your number down, you're hooked up to the machine. They let you get comfortable. And then the examiner the examiner tells you, I want you to answer no to every question I ask. So of course, the examiner will say, did you write down the number 1? And then, of course, you're supposed to say no. So the examinee will say no. About 25 seconds later, the examinee will ask, did you write the number 2? And, of course, you say no. So on and so on and so on until the examiner progresses up to 7. So if you remember, you wrote down 4, 5, or 6, which is actually quite close to 7 as a variable for where he's looking. So this is supposed to give an idea of what the data would look like if the examinee was telling the truth compared to what your data looks like if the examinee is lying. So Neuronumerous came to the agreement that we would run our own version of the numbers test to collect data. We decided that what would make most sense for our purpose is that we do two tests. We would do one as a control group of what the polygraph data looks like if you just ran the numbers test, right, on someone. And the second we would see what happened is if we ran countermeasures against the machine. So the person who's playing the part of the examiner in our homebrew test, who was me, because I actually ended up losing a game of rock, paper, scissors, lizard, Spock, to Urban Monkey, Yeah, I was frickin' paper disproving Spock. But anyway, before the first test started, I would hook a person up to the machine, and I'd ask them to visualize in their head. I didn't have pen and paper. So I asked them to visualize in their head a number between 1 and 10. So they would be told when we start the test that, they would be hooked up, they would get comfortable, we wouldn't start the test until they were ready. I would pause for several seconds so they could get comfortable for the next question. So the second test was run the same as the first, but this time when they answered no to every question in the number sequence, we had the subject run countermeasures to try to fool the machine. Now, a countermeasure can be broadly described as anything that an examinee might do in order to distort or defeat a polygraph test. So, literature suggests that all polygraph countermeasures can be grouped into four categories. So you have physical countermeasures, mental countermeasures, chemical countermeasures, and behavioral countermeasures. So how it works is, as a rule, any method that involves muscular movement as its central feature can be considered a physical countermeasure. Some countermeasure movements would include increasing or releasing of muscle tension, actions that induce pain, muscular activities that deplete the body's energy resources, and alterations in your breathing. Mental countermeasures are those that draw upon psychological manipulations exclusively in order to alter the physiological responses that accompany deception. Mental countermeasures can be further subdivided into the following techniques: hypnosis, biofeedback, placebos, desensitization, mental disposition, rationalization, dissociation, and cognitive overloading. Now, chemical countermeasures are exactly what you expect them to be. You rely on drugs to heighten or dampen physiological arousal during the polygraph examinations. And when it comes to behavioral countermeasures, their principal function is to convince the examiner that the subject is not being deceptive, regardless of what the machine is recording. Another function is to affect the conduct of the examination so the data would be inadequate in order for them to render a decision. So with so many options to choose from, we wanted to keep our variables consistent and make everybody use the same countermeasures. So we went with what we hope would be easiest to do and could be picked up by the subjects immediately, and it would give them enough variety that they could choose among the options for one that would actually give them a sense of comfort, right? The three options were biting their tongue, visualizing thoughts that would make their heart beat faster, and I actually had to ask my friends to flex their anal sphincter muscle for me. That tells you that they're very good friends. So, during the testing phase, we did find that countermeasures could affect the result of the polygraph test. But because we only had 7 days before I'm here, like, in front of you, we didn't have enough time to thoroughly go through the data as much that I would feel comfortable saying that we came to an official response. But unofficially, I would definitely say that our results, they didn't contradict the 2003 National Academy's science report that concluded that countermeasures pose a potentially serious threat to the performance of polygraph testing because all physiological indicators measured by the polygraph can be altered by conscious effort and through cognitive or physical means. So really, even though we're talking about a polygraph and the machine, the bread and butter of all polygraph examinations is the questioning process. One of the early versions they used in the early days was the irrelevant technique, which mixed questions like, did you murder so-and-so, with, is today Tuesday? So they actually had to get rid of it eventually, because even though the premise was lies in response to relevant questions would cause a physiological reaction, the problem was, in this context, that the questions could be stressful enough to produce a result that showed people were lying when they're not. Okay, and because we started late, I'm going to be talking quick as possible. So, the comparison question technique, they got around this by making all the questions accusations. A sex crime investigation, for instance, the suspect would be asked the embarrassing question as, have you committed a sexual act that you were ever ashamed of? as well as the relevant questions to the case. So the point of it was the fact that the people who were guilty, would get a spike for the guilty questions, and everybody else was supposed to be embarrassed by these questions, so they were supposed to spike at a different time. The guilty knowledge question was they would show you like pictures of guns and try to figure out if you had a spike compared to what the murder weapon was. So the fundamental puzzle of the speech I'd really like you to ponder now that we've spent this time together is whether or not we at Numer Numerus have actually built anything more than a machine that collects physiological data. After a near century of polygraph research, there's not really anything else that I can tell you that you guys don't really know, other than the fact that the premise is faulty and it just everything that it's on is not reliable. The problem isn't that the machines don't record anything. They record stuff, and so does our machine. If you build one, you will absolutely record stuff. But the problem is that the numbers are up to human interpretation, and the people running these machines cannot be considered what one calls objective. So the thing is, how the whole thing works in the United States is half of 50 states, you don't have to be licensed to be a polygraph examiner. And there's no test across the board that actually that they do to fulfill the part. So depending on where we're located, we're probably just as qualified as anybody else in that state, and if not more qualified, depending on if you decide building your own machine, that we would know it more thoroughly. So the point is, if you build the machine or if you buy the machine, in time and practice, you will beat the machine. And the thing about this machine is it's just a big polygraph, a big biofeedback device. And as a neurohacker, being able to build this machine, you can actually have it and say that you're doing it for good health. You can learn how to beat the machine and not actually say that you're learning countermeasures because you're actually building a biofeedback machine for good health. So basically, if we could get a bunch of people together to build polygraphs or their own biofeedback machines, they would be less inclined to be using polygraphs because we'd be able to mess up with the variable of what they're using. So, I mean, you have to realize that it's been almost a century that the polygraph has been in use. So as neurohackers, if we could actually use something that we're supposed to be using towards self-improvement and towards good health, in order to be able to eventually make the polygraph obsolete, it really is in our best interest to be able to do it. So, sorry I had to like really speed at the end of it, but that's basically it. So, if you build the machine, and we have all the schematics and the code online, you will be able to be the polygraph. There is no doubt about that. But the fact that you could actually build one and say that you're doing it in the name of good health, we'll definitely throw them. So thank you very much for having your patience with me and everything so late. And thank everybody else who helped us. And good luck with your biofeedback devices.